Hello and welcome to another episode of the We Have a Meeting podcast. So today we're joined by an incredible mind from the world of venture capital. Communication, negotiation and growth are all skills that sit at the top of today's guest CV. We're incredibly lucky to be joined by the growth manager of Fuel Ventures, a company that fuels the growth of exceptional companies and work with them to help them grow. Our guest today is James Deboulay. James, how are you?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for joining us. So James, we kick off our podcast the same way every time. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
My background is I've always been a salesman of sort or a fundraiser. I started off in the city about 32 years ago. I've sold conventional asset classes like funds and investment trusts and hedge funds. And about 10 years ago, I moved into the world of early stage technology. Originally raising money from a small boutique investment bank, and then more latterly for the last 3 years working for a venture capital company set up by a chap called Mark Pearson, who was an entrepreneur himself, who set up and was a sole shareholder and exited a business called MyVentureCos.com. Fuel Venture is an early stage backer of technology businesses, platforms and marketplaces with a valuation of sub £12 million, and we allocate between £1 and £4 million per deal into EIS deal flow. And my job is effectively, when those portfolio companies get out of the Series A, which is past our investment remit, I will try and help them find the most strategic and best investor to take them on the next part of their journey.
Okay. And then if you're there and you're taking them to the next part of the journey, typically, how would you do that?
So I think the first thing is everything always is about how you present a situation or an opportunity. So what you need to do is you need to help the founder, who is always going to be over focused on what they're doing, because it is such an emotional journey and they've sweated blood and tears to get to where they want to. But to make them look at it from an external point of view. Now, the person who might be investing might not be a specialist in this particular area. They might be a generalist. So it's making the story as succinct and short and brief, but getting across the major points as quickly as possible. And those major points would be things like your addressable market, your competitive moat, what points of protection, how you've grown your revenues over a certain period of time. And other facts that you think that might differentiate you from the other deal flow that people would see.
So, James, I'm going to ask you to imagine something. It's going to be very, very easy. But imagine me and Jack are 5 years old. From meeting us now, it's probably very easy to imagine. But if you had to describe the particular kind of funding you specialize in to a five-year-old, how would you best explain it?
The area of funding I try to help is the funder who will have the most commonality with the founder of the business. So like everything else in life, it's about relationships. And therefore, that there are always going to be good times and there are going to be bad times. And it's to try and pair the founder and our portfolio company up with someone who can take them on that next level of the journey.
Okay. And what's the typical nuances there? So what kind of founders, what are you looking for in a founder, as these are the tick boxes that would mean that they are best suited to this particular approach?
So I'd probably flip that on the head, because I only work with companies that we at Fuel Ventures have previously backed. And so more it's about me trying to match them up with the potential investor. So I would probably look at what areas they previously invested in and what the outcomes have been from those investments. And again, who they've handed those investments on to before. So, for example, if let's say it was a B2B software company, normally what's their exit been? Has it been via an IPO, a market listing, or has it been via a strategic sale? And how do I think that founder will get on with that investor, and is that route a suitable route for them?
James, I imagine that your calendar on a daily basis, I'm sure 2 days never look the same. I'm sure you're a man of many different talents and tasks and things like that. So what does your role entail on a daily basis? Like what are some of the key drivers that you have to do to complete a day's work?
So I suppose because of my background, having been in asset management firms and in investment banking, I have an incredibly structured approach to how I try to raise money. So there are about 60 different investors I speak to in terms of firms, and they will vary from venture capitalists to private equity to family offices to strategic investors. And I will try and have a conversation with each one of those on a quarterly basis so that they know what my deal flow is for the next quarter. And we can discuss it briefly and they can tell me whether it fits into the remit of what they're doing. I also spend a huge amount of time listening to what's happening in stock markets and also global economics, because as a salesperson, I think the most important thing you can ever do on a call is to leave the person you're talking to with a piece of information that they didn't know before. There's no bigger compliment than the fact that they can go and repeat it later. And also it means that they'll actually pick up the call to you next time, because they're not going to think you're on trying to sell them something every single time.
That's an interesting one. I guess 60 different people that you speak to on like a quarterly basis, like how important is relationship building in your role, and what are some of the key things that you do to build these relationships? So like that was a prime example. Is there anything else that you bring to the table when it comes to building those relationships?
No, it's funny. I think that the thing about the world of venture capital, having worked in lots of different elements of finance, is it's a super friendly area, much more friendly than any other areas I've worked in. And people actually want to help other people out. So as long as it's approached in a non-pushy, aggressive manner, most people will give you the time of day. So 100%, I think it's like everything else. It's based on relationships. And the more you get to know someone and the more you take an effort to actually understand about them and what, whether it's their family or whether it's about what specific area they're particularly interested in, then I think that people are genuinely extremely willing to help if they can, and quite willing. For me, I found that a number of the best deals I've landed for the portfolio companies have come through having a conversation with someone and them saying, no, this isn't quite right for me, but actually you should go and speak to Joe at so-and-so or John at so-and-so, and therefore the introduction being made that way rather than actually directly.
And I'd imagine, James, at this stage in your career, you've probably got a sixth sense for what the pulse of a good investment looks like. What are those things that you can spot early on that you think this is going to work? There's something about this.
To me, I'm a salesperson, so I love people with energy and enthusiasm. And one of the things I like most of all is I think that most people, by the time they get to my age in the city, they feel a bit worn out and drawn. And actually, that level of energy that now is around with all these new and young founders, that's incredibly infectious. And the interesting thing is actually about when you go on a call with a founder and with a potential investor, is to make sure actually they go onto that call like it's the first call of the day, maximum energy, maximum enthusiasm.
Can I pose a challenge to that?
Yeah, of course.
And see what you think in your experience. So, me and Jack, we work with lots and lots of different businesses. We get brought in to do the sales on their behalf. And some people I've met have been amazing, energetic founders. And I've thought, I would like to spend time with this person in my personal life. That translates to when we're working with them as someone who's a bit of a pain and someone who's a bit difficult and expectations aren't quite aligned and it's a bit all over the place. Do you know what I'm talking about? Or
No, I know exactly. I mean, what also, as a non-founder, you've got to be super cognizant about is a lot of these people have put their whole lives on hold and every fiber of their, and therefore they are going to be super sensitive to any nuance. And fun enough, that's why Some of the people who are in my role just do the introduction and then they let the founder get on with it. And I always try and go on those calls with the founder, because sometimes the founder is so busy answering the question that they want to answer rather than the question that's potentially being posed by the investor. And as to your point about, it's like anything in life, founders are made of all sorts. And so therefore there are some, it's a special kind of person that can go and start a company and risk all to go and do it. And therefore, sometimes you can get more quirky ones than others.
I like it.
But I suppose it's about picking out what you see and getting them to highlight the bits that you feel as though are going to show them in the best light.
Good answer. Fuel Ventures is, it's not for everybody. It's not for everybody as a VC. So what are some of the key factors that determine whether a startup is a good fit? Like, what is it that you would look for Fuel?
So I'm not on the investment team, but because I've done a reasonable amount of investing myself, I sort of specialized in, or I'm asked to help in bits of DD when it comes to certain types of fintech businesses where I might have relevant experiences. And so what Fuel looks for is we are earlier stage than most of the other EIS businesses. So we only want to see some kind of commercial traction, which is more than your nan or your dad or your aunt or whatever, who's bought three of whatever, or you've got an app that you've got three subscribers now and you're going to have 10 billion by next week. It's about showing that someone wants to buy the product that you're selling. It's about, we also state that we intend to try and produce a return of 10 times your money within 8 to 10 years for our investors. Now, a number of these businesses might not work out as well as we want to. Some might not work out at all, but we rely on a few outsized returns. So the main things we look for are, is there a very large market? Is the founder being realistic about what percentage of that market he can actually acquire? If you say the value of the market is £1 billion and I'm going to have 95% of it, it's pretty unlikely you're going to achieve that. But if you're, if you worked on the fact that you might be able to get 5% and you can clearly show that route to market. And another really important thing is, have you assessed your competition? And I would say that 99% of the time when we have a founder on a call and they say, I haven't got any competition, it's because they haven't done enough research. So even if you can't obviously see competition, you want to be able to highlight something, because it makes you look as though you've thought about the process.
I'm sure that you've seen a lot of people come to the, we have this conversation a lot where people are like, we're unique, we're one of a kind. It's like, well, there has to be.
So interestingly, we see 400 companies a month,
wow,
come through or apply for money. And to put it into context, we probably invest through our core fund, which is Scale Up, in about 12 a year.
Okay.
So that gives you an idea. And Fuel is somewhat different, I think, to most VCs, mainly led by Mark, who's incredibly keen on LinkedIn. And fun enough, I was a bit skeptical about that when I joined Fuel, because I thought it was all a bit sort of flashy and showy. And the interesting thing is it drives a huge amount of founders to engage with us, because their view is, if we are so aggressively marketing portfolio companies and highlighting their successes, then we will do the same for them.
Do you have anything anecdotal, James, of any of the companies that have come through, any of the 12 that have been selected, that have what they did that shone, or what they did that stood out that made Fuel say, you know what, we feel like this is a safe bet?
So I think it's seed investing. You never say, if you say it's a safe bet, you're probably kidding yourself. But the fact is, it's about trying to mitigate as many of the potential pitfalls. And again, that's something highlighted by Mark, in that he said when he started Fuel is, I've been through all the ups and downs of being a founder. And if I can help some of these founders not make some of the mistakes I did, then I will be giving them a colossal advantage. But one of the things which obviously stands out is if we can find an exited founder. So someone that's done the journey before. And there are quite a few of those around. And I think also our ability, although we're a generous investor in an early stage, we really like to try and get involved with our portfolio companies and add value where we think we can. And that might be by an introduction, either to a firm that might be able to help. It might be an introduction to another investor. It might be an introduction to a potential acquirer. And that was well proven with a business we invested in called Content Cal, which had a fantastic founder. And they were acquired by Adobe at the end of last year for a very nice return. And actually, realistically, it probably was a bit early for an exit, but it was just an opportunity that was so extraordinary because one of our other investors knew Adobe well, and he knew that what Content Cal was doing was in Adobe's roadmap. And therefore, there was the opportunity for them to acquire it and fill that gap incredibly quickly. And again, it's then helping the founder to understand how far he can go in terms of pushing the offer or what the point is when to say, yes, thanks very much, or no, thank you. And it's about providing that guidance, because I think otherwise these situations can be incredibly lonely, and therefore you can make a decision. These decisions could affect people for the rest of their lives. You know, the correct exit. Now, most founders, you'll very rarely see a founder who says, okay, that's fine, I've done my one company and I've exited and I'm done now. Because actually, it's not purely money driven. It's about it's like a scoreboard against your peer group, and it's the ever achieving successes.
That's interesting. I was actually just going to ask you about that. So exited founders, probably your Maslow's hierarchy of needs, ticked through and through many, many times at that point when you've exited a business. So what do you think it is that gets them coming back each time? You mentioned that the tick box against the peer group. What else is bringing them back to the trenches to go again?
Because I think that often when they've I think often when someone starts a company, this is just what I hear back, is I think that they're fully engaged, but suddenly they see another opportunity along the way, and they almost like bank that and say, I need to focus on this. Because I think one of the greatest assets a founder can have is an ability to have a laser focused, while at the same time having an awareness to what's going on, but not focusing too much about what's going on the periphery, but always an awareness. And therefore, I think that's the temptation, is to come back. And also because quite often it's a team of people together who've worked together and they know each other's strengths and weaknesses. And actually, it doesn't really matter what the business is. They know each other's strengths and weaknesses, whether that's problem solving or sales or whatever.
I'd like to pose a psychological question. We had an American founder, American investor on the other week. I asked him the same question. Do you think founders need to have either an inferiority or a superiority complex in order to be consistent?
I think that it's such a cop-out, but I'm going to say a healthy blend of both. So I think you need to have a confidence in yourself, but also humility is a great attribute for anyone to have, because investors just don't like arrogant people, because on the whole, they want to be the arrogant person in the room. That's why you see all these VC founders sort of sitting back with their feet on the table, not the founders, sorry, the investors sitting back with their feet on the table. And, you know, you see all these things on LinkedIn and everywhere else. And I think VCs have extraordinary confidence sometimes, and sometimes it's well-placed and sometimes it's totally misplaced. But I do also think that the current environment we're in is revealing a lot more about the situation now, because there isn't such thing as free money, and people there's much more of a competition for investors' money, whereas previously it was a lot freer and it was a lot easier for founders to find money. I think now you have to really stand out, and there were a lot of rubbish businesses that got backed over the last 3 years.
Is that a COVID issue?
No, it's a free money issue.
Okay.
The thing is if you look at it logically now, you can get 6% return on investing in a 2-year government gilt, whereas you're taking a lot of risk on where the upside is huge, mm-hmm. but the downside is also zero. So in an environment where there's another thing that's really important is that from an investor's point of view was 2 years ago, you would say to your founder, growth of revenues is everything. Just get it, smash stuff, don't worry about it, carry on building. Whereas now most investors are saying, when are you going to be at break even? You need to control your metrics. You need to watch your, I'd rather have a lower revenue with a better profitability than have a, it's not all about growth anymore.
Okay.
I think that will change in time. I think that will change in time because as everyone, you know, in my parents' generation, you had interest rates or people were paying 14% interest rates. And there's, humans are incredibly adaptable and they will get used to whatever's thrown at them if they have enough time. It's just the problem is that change has been too quick recently.
I think that leads nicely on to my next question. So if you were a found up starter and you're going out to start pitching to VCs, what is it that makes a good pitch? What advice could you give them?
So I think you're, the first thing is the email that you send or your way of approaching. First of all, do a bit of research into what they've invested in previously. Keep your email short, like 6 bullet points of why, what differentiates you, size of market. Get them excited about what the possibility of the return profile is. And then in terms of presentations, I've sort of got a bit of a golden rule is that a presentation should never take more than 25 minutes and it shouldn't be more than 2 minutes on each slide. So it should be about 12 pages long. And therefore, and if it's less than 1 minute on a page, you shouldn't have the slide. You should combine it with something else. And visuals. And the problem is if you write too much on a presentation, whoever's looking at it will spend too long reading it and they won't be paying attention to what you're saying. So if you can produce visuals with just bullet point numbers on the side of the slide, that's really helpful.
How much do investors want to see something quirky or outside of the box, or would they rather just see something like, this is the norm, we know it, like you're saying there with the slides, like do we want to just see something like that, or do you want something a little bit extra to show that you're a bit different?
I don't know. I think the danger about doing that is you can normally exceed it and then just look a bit odd. So I'd say you're not selling your presentation skill, you're selling your ability to make that investor money. So it doesn't really matter how you put it. Don't try and be too adventurous unless you're doing a graphics design business, and then you probably need to. But most things, it's just they want to understand why you're better than anyone else, why they should put money in your company rather than someone else's.
Are there like...
Why you understand that better than anyone else does.
Is there like... a list of boxes, like from the inside, that's like, we need, if we're going to invest, like it, I'm guessing it's not done on a gut feel. It's more, do they tick these 3 to 5 to 10 boxes?
So I think at early in stage investing, it is done much more on a gut feel, but it also, because there's no numbers or figures to go on. You're having to say, does this founder enthuse me? That he really knows his market and that he is bringing something innovative. And it doesn't matter if there are 10 other competitors, if that market can take 10 other competitors. You don't need to. I mean, it's like the Betamax VHS story. It wasn't necessarily, VHS wasn't the best. Supposedly everyone says Betamax was. It's about, can you put your story across well to the market, and do you understand your sales channel? Do you understand your route to market clearly? And how have you mapped that out? How much have you thought about it? What's your thoughts on if something comes into play that you weren't expecting, how quickly can you pivot? Because very few founders, the presentation they originally give is actually what will happen. It's like, I've never seen a founder who's produced financials where they've ever been even close to what happens in the end. But if you can explain about how you got to those numbers and there's a thought process, because these numbers are sometimes 3 or 4 years out, and that's just make-believe.
Okay. And then I'm really thinking, so we know that we're probably going to have people listening to this podcast who might be young entrepreneurs. They're going to be the next Richard Branson of the world, and they've got brilliant ideas and they might be starting something small. You must have sat there with so many founders throughout your time, and you must have met so many people. What advice would you give to somebody just starting out on this journey right now?
Never give up. I mean, I have to say, I had a call with another one of our founders this morning who'd had a setback, and yet his resilience was quite outstanding. And that is the biggest standout to me, and that's what produces exceptional founders. And there are two or three within our portfolio who've had extremely difficult situations to deal with, and it's the ability to react in a positive way. There's a wonderful saying, which is, the greatest glory is not in never falling, but in rising each time we fall. And I think that's incredibly apt. And it's always, because everyone will struggle with their business career, whether it's as an entrepreneur or anything else. And it's the ability to be able to look beyond that and to pick yourself up and go again. And sometimes your business might fail, but the willingness to get up and try again with something else or with the same business.
I feel like a lot of the business owners and entrepreneurs, especially in the SaaS and tech space that we sit down with, we'll probably have some form of optimism bias, where very blue sky thinking, everything's going to be okay, we're going to make it through the storm. Is that something you see?
Well, I have to say, I think they can have more optimism in B2B enterprise software than you would have in B2C, because obviously you're reliant on the consumer environment. And I think, yes, you have to have a huge element of optimism. Otherwise, you wouldn't start something from scratch. I mean, it's interesting. There's been a decent movement in the last 6 to 9 months, purely because a lot of people have lost their appetite for starting up completely, is this acquire and build model, where you acquire a business that has done the painful bit at the start. But the interesting thing is also that provides, again, another opportunity for founders, that if they feel as though they need someone else to take it onto the next stage, they potentially have some kind of exit route.
Okay.
But I think most founders, once they've done the hard work, they want to stick with it and see it to the end.
Yeah, it's their own personal baby, and they've watched it through the toddler years and try and put its hand in the fire, and now it's time to watch it grow into a young man. I wanted to talk to you about...
Or lady, James.
I wanted to talk to you about bootstrapping. So obviously you said you have about 400 each month. So when is it more advisable for entrepreneurs to just bootstrap their business rather than seeking venture capital funding?
So I mean, the ultimate truth is this market is a tough market, and it's not, as we said earlier, it's not going to change in a hurry. Now, investment is considerably more dilutive than it was a year and a half ago, because people are paying lower valuations and low multiples. So it depends on the founder's A, ability to fund it, and B, ability to take on risk. Now, if you're a previously exited founder, obviously you've got much more capability. Now, ultimately, the honest truth is probably, if you're an exited founder and you're able to fund it, you want to fund it as long as possible, because you've got another person giving you an opinion that you're not necessarily going to agree with, but they're going to have quite a big stake in your company, so they've got a reasonable amount of say. So it depends on so many factors, whether it's, you know, your own individual confidence. Do you need someone else to work with? Do you appreciate what a venture capital business might or another investor might bring to the table? And that doesn't need to be a venture capitalist. Sometimes it might just be someone that's an ex-professional within industry, within a much larger blue chip firm, that might be able to give you an opinion that might be hugely helpful. It, interestingly for me in the world of finance and banking, is there's a lot of people who've worked for big blue chip names who I'm not going to mention on here, who actually need that blue chip name. And without that blue chip name, they find it very, very difficult to survive. So on the whole, entrepreneurs are quite different from the more strategic advisors. But sometimes it's just good to have someone to challenge what you're thinking.
And then if there is an entrepreneur who's now starting up on a journey and they're thinking bootstrap, maybe venture capital, what are the three attributes or skills that you would say go away, study, get good at quickly? Because these are going to be the three things that you need to take this business to the next level.
I think on most businesses, it's the ability to be able to manage people. And that's massively underestimated, because you've got to be a team player, but at the same time, you're a leader. So you have to slightly separate yourself away at certain points. I think the ability to be able to understand issues that are going wrong within your business and then be able to put them across clearly, and that might be the same as the first point. The ability to understand your market and how quickly it might be moving, and probably incredibly importantly is a basic grasp on financials, because the biggest issue that we see is where founders receive some money and they go out splashing it all over the place, and then suddenly they turn around and say, I've got 3 months worth of runway, what do I do? And then they're at the mercy of the investors, because the investors, you know, it's about the value of your money, and therefore it's risk versus reward. So I would always say to a founder, you want to, if you possibly can, have 12 months worth of runway in front of you. It takes roughly 6 months to raise the money on a Series A round. So you need to keep that runway ahead of you.
The ones that get it wrong, James, where do they, I want it to sound a bit like Brewster's Millions, but the ones that get it wrong, where do they go and splash that money typically? What kind of areas or what kind of things do they waste the money on?
I've got to be very careful about this, because whatever I say, I'm going to offend some department in some firm. But I think normally it's on sales channels of some sort, where they haven't actually worked out what the market fit is in terms of distribution. Are they better to be, you know, individual sales? Should they be channel sales? Should they be selling through someone else's channel sales? And again, that can be an incredibly costly business, and the run up to the conversion. I think also the other thing is that on most B2B software enterprise, those the length of closing a contract has extended quite dramatically. And that was sort of started by COVID, because you couldn't get six people together to sign a document. So it was all bouncing around on DocuSign. And then I think that people, as times have got tougher, have been more reticent about committing themselves into long-term contracts. So to me, normally most of the issues lie in a misfit with the sales function. And that's not because the salesmen aren't good or anything else. It's just because management haven't properly assessed or pivoted quickly enough to benefit fully.
As a company, obviously this is what we do. We work with a lot of tech, SaaS, and a lot of startups. You'd be so surprised at companies when we have the initial conversation where they don't know their go-to-market or they don't know their strategy. So I think what you're saying there is 1,000,000% true. James, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I've really enjoyed this. So thank you for taking the time to join us. If anybody wants to apply for Fuel Ventures or they want to get in touch with you, what should they do?
Well, in terms of deal flow for Fuel Ventures, is we have a portal on the website. But, you know, if you want to reach out, then I'm on LinkedIn. It's James de Boulin at Fuel Ventures. But I will always try and help. But I do get quite a lot of messages on a daily basis. And this isn't I'm not the person that can say yes or no. I'm sort of like a sort of filter that acts on the outside. And then I'm either listened to or not listened to accordingly.
I like it. You're somebody that's trusted enough to put in a good word, but maybe if somebody's looking for investment, go via the portal.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, James.